Okay, a brief introduction to alpha turbulence. So those of you who've seen a couple of transparencies in the conference last week, please be patient. Yes, this is the next one, I think. Yeah. Okay, this is just to remind you of the setting. We are considering incompressible magnetohydrodynamics. The first equation is the momentum equation, just the Navier-Stokes, supplemented by Lorentz force. This pressure has both gas and magnetic pressure in it. This is the induction equation governing the evolution of magnetic configurations. And the divergence free condition applies for both the velocity and the magnetic fields. Okay. Now, because the situation is, we are considering is incompressible, and the density has been taken to be uniform and constant, it's useful to rewrite the magnetic field in velocity units. Okay? So, we will take the magnetic field divided by square root 4 pi rho as a measure of the magnetic field. And when you have a mean magnetic field, such a measure is called the Alphin speed. I'll come to that soon. It's also useful to recast these equations in a form that is symmetric. In terms of variables that were introduced by Elsasser, what he did was essentially to take V plus and minus B, written in these units, and plug it into these equations, and you find the equations of MHD assume this really symmetric form. Okay, this is 1950. These look so much like hydrodynamic equations of Elsasser. He had a conjecture that perhaps MST turbulence would be very similar to hydrodynamic turbulence in the inertial range. You'll notice over here that I've dropped dissipative terms because I'll be mostly considering situations in the inertial range where explicit dissipation is not important. And in any case, these are sort of fake. You know. Okay. For a purely hydrodynamic case, nu del square V is an excellent dissipative term. But in MHD, when you get down to really small scales, you'll have to worry about collision-less damping and so on, where writing it in the simple scalar form is misleading. So let's consider an unperturbed state where the velocity is zero. It's static. It has a uniform magnetic field. So I've introduced the Alphin speed over here, which is the speed at which magnetic disturbances in the system propagate. It's the communication speed in the system. Because we are considering an incompressible situation, the sound speed is infinite. So let's write the Elsasser perturbations, Elsasser variables, as the mean plus perturbation. So put it in, substitute this in Elsasser's equations, get something like this. I've written the linear terms on the left, and the nonlinear term contributes directly to the pressure, because the role of the pressure in an incompressible fluid is to keep perturbations incompressible. Okay, it's not directly linked to thermodynamics. So this tells us that if one of these fields, let's say W plus, is zero, then this term is zero, the pressure also doesn't contribute, then W minus obeys a linear equation which has this very simple solution that says that W minus is a wave that propagates parallel to the magnetic field. Okay. Similarly for W plus. So these are completely nonlinear solutions that are stable in themselves. Okay. So at t equal to 0, you construct some W minus as an arbitrary function of x, y, and z, and it propagates without change in form along the magnetic field. because of the existence of these solitary wave solutions, it struck Kreitman that any turbulence in this system can only occur when a W plus meets a W minus. Okay? So that's when the nonlinear terms become important. I mean, they are non-zero. And then any turbulent cascade is due to a collision, can be thought of as a collision between a W plus and a W minus wave packet. Or as a series of collisions if there are many such wave packets. Okay? So you should imagine that these wave packets are running up and down the field at the alpha speed. Okay? Which is a finite quantity. So if you imagine that W plus and minus are perturbations whose amplitudes are much smaller than the alpha velocity, then any collision, a single collision between two wave packets is of short duration. Okay? So a single collision causes only small perturbations.
Has anybody found these stationary solutions?
Yeah.
You can write them down.
I think so. I've read a statement in Chandrasekhar's book on magneto hydrodynamics that these solutions are stable. Okay, but stable should be qualified.
Say, you know, there are
no, I should say that it should be qualified in the following sense: that if I were to create a W plus packet, a positive packet, and put a small negative perturbation on it. Okay. Surely there is a situation which will take the system far from its initial state. It will just separate with some perturbation. Okay. I don't know if you would like to call this stable or not. I've read that these are stable. Yes, that is right. Incompressibility. Okay, sure. I agree. So the first realization is that any single collision between a W plus packet and a minus packet is weak. Okay? But the effect of subsequent collisions could build up this perturbation, perhaps in a random fashion, and you know, leading to a situation where the net perturbation is about a unit. Okay? Now, because there are wave packets moving in opposite directions, and you can't transform to another frame, uniformly moving frame, where the effect of the large scale field can be removed. Okay. Now this is an important consideration, because in hydrodynamic turbulence, small scale eddies would be affected by the large scale flow, and if you're sitting at a point and looking at correlation times, without following a fluid particle that's already in correlation times, then you'd find a very short correlation time, because the small scale eddy is is affected by the large scale field. So clearly this doesn't directly contribute to the dynamics of interactions between small scale eddies. So one would like to transform away the effect of the large scale field, which is called sweeping, but in MHC turbulence you cannot get rid of the mean magnetic field. So you can ask why are we worrying about a situation where there's a mean magnetic field? Okay, it is perhaps a generic situation. In the sense, if you have field on some large scale, okay, it will act as a mean magnetic field, uniform magnetic field for inertial range eddies which are really small. Okay, so perhaps generic MHC turbulence in an incompressible fluid has the same local structure as alpha turbulence. Okay. So it's important to consider that. So Crick didn't realize much of this, you know, all of this in fact. And then he worked out a sort of physical argument for to estimate the power spectrum of an assumed homogeneous and isotropic cascade with these considerations in mind. Okay, where you think of adding up collisions successively with random phases. Okay, so I just quote the result for a perturbation, let's say on the outer scale, on some scale little l, which I call the outer scale, which has an amplitude v sub l. For a perturbation that is weak compared to the alpha in speed, the spectrum of fluctuations which develops in the inertial range as energy cascades from scale L to much smaller scales is given by 1 over k power 7 by 2. Okay, the 7 half should be compared with 11 thirds which you obtain for the Kolmogorov inertial range spectrum for hydrodynamics. Okay, and this is due to this Alphen effect. It's interesting how Krakenman came by this 7 halves and these arguments. It had to do with his developing a system of closure called DIA, where he had applications to hydrodynamics in mind, and when he looked for an inertial range spectrum, he found something with 7 halves, okay, for hydrotable. Okay, he was clearly wrong. He realized it was wrong, and he also realized the source of the error, that it was because of the sweeping. Okay, and he was imaginative enough to turn this into something real for energy turbulence. Okay, that's right. Yeah, he had already done Lagrangian DIA, but he realized that DIA by itself could be used. The sweeping effect is real in MHD. Okay, it's there in this paper. Of the sweep. Now, the theory is apparently self-consistent. Okay, one has assumed that the perturbation is weak on the large scale. Okay, so one should check that the perturbations remain weak as you go down to small scales. Otherwise, it would not be correct to add up successive collisions between wave packets with random phases. Okay, the weakness should be maintained. So a measure of weakness, one measure of weakness is the wave period divided by cascade time on any scale. Okay, so here you imagine wave packets which are big colliding, creating smaller scales, creating wave packets of still smaller scale, and on any scale you could ask, how long does a wave packet last? Okay, so that is a cascade. So the estimate is that it goes as 1 over k power 1 half. So clearly, as you go down the inertial range to smaller and smaller spatial scales or to larger k's, the interactions get weaker and weaker, so hence apparently more self-consistent. Okay, but unfortunately, it is impossible to put this set of physical arguments into a theory where you can calculate something. Okay, so a theory as I understand it looks quite different. All of Krakenman's physical picture, much of it is correct. Okay, the thing that gives trouble is isotropy. Okay, it's not unexpected that when you have a strong mean magnetic field, that the resulting spectrum would be anisotropic, but its consequences are really drastic. It's not just a sort of perturbation on something that's spherically symmetric. Okay, it controls everything. So here I've been sort of careful to draw the resultant spectrum in k space as a function of k top and k parallel. Okay, again I assume roughly isotropic excitation on some large scale L with small amplitudes. Okay? Initially, the cascade in K-space is clearly completely perpendicular to the magnetic field, which means if this is the magnetic field and you created some disturbance which is roughly isotropic about that scale, something that's spherical becomes narrower in the perpendicular direction while retaining its parallel correlation length. Okay? So it creates longer eddies, which is what I've shown here. Okay? This is a regime which could be called intermediate turbulence. I won't use the word weak for a technical reason. Okay? So I'll just say it in words. Individual collisions are weak. If you make an estimate of, let's say, wave period to cascade time, that is again small, but that is only one measure of weakness. Okay? We, that is me and my collaborator Peter Goldreich, been working on this, think is that terms of every order, okay, that is first order perturbation, second, third, etc., contribute about equally. So perturbation theory itself diverges, okay, whereas one measure of weakness, which is wave period by cascade time, remains small. Okay, so you can call the second small parameter as strain in the fluid. Okay, basic perturbative variable in fluid dynamics is the strain tensors. Okay, so that becomes about a unit. Okay, so this we call intermediate turbulence, where the small parameter remains small. Is initially small. For instance, when K perp is of order 1 over L, which is the outer scale, the small parameter initially starts off as the fractional perturbation squared. Okay? But as you go down the inertial range, it increases as K perp. Okay? While at some critical K sub C, it becomes of order unity. That's when the So you should imagine that in the background there is another small parameter, which is the fluid strain, which is already of order unity. The second small parameter starts small and becomes of order unity at some critical scale, which depends on the excitation and the outer scale. Okay? When that also becomes of order unity, turbulence turns strong. Okay? Now this is a conjecture that the turbulence will maintain itself such that both these small parameters, both these parameters, that is the strain and the ratio of the wave period to cascade time, both these parameters remain of order unity. Okay, it's sort of saturated state. Okay, now such a saturated state allows for the growth of K parallel. Okay, so this is a case where the wave period, the cascade time is always of order the wave period, and as the cascade time gets smaller and smaller, so does the wave period, and that allows K parallel to grow, because the wave frequency is proportional to K parallel for alpha waves. Short waves have a higher frequency. Short waves in the parallel direction. Okay, so here I've shown the growth of K parallel, but the growth is slow. Growing as K parallel, K perp to 2/3. So I've given the spectrum over here for both intermediate as well as strong turbulence. Okay? Intermediate turbulence exists between the outer scale and KC. The power spectrum, it's a three-dimensional power spectrum, goes as 1 over K perp cube. The same power spectrum for strong turbulence goes as 1 over K perp to 10/3. Times the function of K parallel by Q, which essentially constrains the spectrum to remain within this region. Okay? So you should think of Q is a function of K perp. Okay? So it gives you the power parallel size of an eddy given its perpendicular size. Okay, I'll go ahead now, just mentioning that when, even though this power looks odd, if you look at the RMS velocity fluctuation on a perpendicular scale lambda, it goes as lambda to one-third, much like in Kolmogorov turbulence. So you should think of these, of this as some anisotropic Kolmogorov spectrum. Okay? So, having given this background, I wish to consider the wandering of magnetic field lines in a quite generic situation, but for specific application, I'll come back to strong and intermediate turbulence. Okay? Yes? Pardon? Driven. Driven. Steadily driven turbulence. On outer scale L with. It is true that decaying turbulence also goes in this fashion. I think, Jason, have you studied decaying turbulence? No, sorry if I didn't mention it before, but I had in mind a situation where there was steady driving. Okay? Think of it this way. I drive it once, watch it decay, drive it again, and so on and so forth. It's like a statistically steady situation. I supply the energy on the outer scale, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Okay. He's done simulation, so he should know. I haven't really looked at decaying turbulence.
I want to ask about the time
and the duration of physical time and the wave number.
Time.
Sorry, I can't. I mean, I can give you guesses, but. They're no good. I mean, I haven't estimated it. Okay. Any other questions? I'm going to move on. Yeah. Yes.
Right.
Yes. 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 Okay. That's right.
Right.
Yes.
Get the usual B at a certain scale and goes like L to the minus one third.
That's right. Correct.
And the other hypothesis could have flat.
Yes.
Right.
Right. That's right. That's right. Yes.
But you've got those two factors, you can get this
thing. Yes, I completely agree. Yeah.
Just give me a little more insight into that second critical balance.
Okay.
I've got comfortable with it from over.
Okay.
Critical
balance.
Yeah. You've got these waves.
That's right. Okay. Okay. So let's think perturbatively in this regime. Okay. There are the dominant interactions don't affect K parallel, either three wave, four wave, or so on. Okay. So you think of it as first order perturbative, second order, and so on. The dominant ones leave this unaffected. Okay? Those are the shortest time scale. But at second order, okay, which is four wave, there are certain four wave interactions which can be described as follows. Okay? It's an interaction with a long wavelength, let's say alpha wave, which is traveling in the negative direction. Okay, a positive wave meets a long wavelength wave, is destabilized by it, and splits into two waves, two positive waves. This increases the frequency of decreases the frequency of the initial alpha N wave. It splits into two daughter waves, which have lower frequency. Okay, so when this happens, this is a mechanism, and there is an inverse process too. So this is a mechanism which can change K parallel. And if you make the estimate, in this regime, it is subdominant, but at precisely Kc, it assumes equal importance as all the other interactions which don't affect K parallel. So there are all these, you know, four, five, I mean, all higher order interactions which all rise to order unity at Kc. So there is a mechanism which allows for the growth of K parallel. And I can make estimates for you and show that it happens precisely at Kc.
And so we argue that K parallel couldn't get larger than that because that would be the mode with this linearly moving around the region.
Yeah, after that I don't have even reasonable arguments. Yeah. Okay. I don't know. Why K parallel wouldn't get large? Oh no, okay, I can show this much, that when, let's say, these four wave interactions, which allow for the growth of K parallel, when they are of order, the lowest order interaction, think of it this way. When you are in this regime, think of the two strongest interactions, the three wave interactions which push the turbulence this way, the cascade this way, the frequency changing interactions which allow for the growth of K parallel. They are apparently of unequal orders. One is third order and the other is fourth order. Okay, three wave and four wave. Okay. When they are of equal orders, they are exactly balanced when K parallel goes as K perp to 2/3. Okay. So this I can show. But if you were to ask me a question, I mean, why doesn't it go beyond? Why doesn't one overtake the other? I don't know. It's a guess. It's a hypothesis. I can't show it. Third and let's say first order and second order. Yeah, not beyond that. Okay. Yeah, that's right. That much I can show. Yeah, yeah, that's right. That's right. So it is reasonable. Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, if I started out with some energy over here. Yeah, and that might cascade like this till it hits this cone. Yeah, that's what I would expect.
So there is a sort of attraction to that cone.
Yeah, that's the guess, that there are similar time scales for transfer. That is the best argument I can come up with for saying that it will stay within this cone. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, go on, go on. I mean, we have all the time. Yeah, go on.
Supposing you had waves that had K parallel whatsoever, right, along the line K parallel with zero. Sure, it would be the same.
Pardon, let me try to understand what you're saying. I mean, you didn't, sorry, can you say that again? You didn't?
Along K parallel with zero.
Yes.
So it would be the same. If all the energy was along there.
Okay, how do you want to put it? It's certainly not isotropic, but...
No, I just want to put some energy right on the K parallel equals zero line.
And remove everything else, or... Initially.
Yeah, why would it spread out? I don't
You want to make everything two-dimensional. So these are mainly two-dimensional configurations, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know what 2D configurations are stable. Go on, go on. Right.
What would happen to that? Because that would look like almost like interference, right? And it would be completely two-dimensional. I think it would. This is why there is a one-dimensional
process. So you've actually run these? Okay, what happens? It spreads, it stays.
Well, here's a two-dimensional code, but we don't know if it's unstable.
Oh, is that right? Oh, okay, fine. Okay, then that doesn't matter. Yeah. Okay, it's a good question. I don't know. I'll have to think about it. Definitely, I'll have to think about it. I don't know what happens if you concentrate energy. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, now we'll let the field wander. Okay. So let's say we have, some turbulent situation. And we've taken a snapshot, okay? So it's a sort of tangle of field lines, okay, extending along the z direction. So I want you to imagine that this dashed line is the unperturbed field, okay? It's sort of static, it's uniform, and turbulence has made that field line go in this wavy fashion. It pierces the xy plane somewhere and then is moved by a position vector x in the perpendicular direction, essentially because of the perturbations in the magnetic field. So I assume that the perturbations are shear alphane like, okay? So which means that the perturbations are perpendicular to the mean magnetic field, okay? And of course they are incompressible, in the sense divergence of B is zero, and because they are in the perpendicular direction, it's only the perpendicular divergence that counts, and that's zero. So if you follow a field line, think of this position vector x as two-dimensional in the xy plane, dx by dz equal to delta B by B naught. You're just following one field line. And let me call delta B by B naught as some u, so the function of x, y, and z. Okay? It's clear if you sort of think of x and y as 2D space and z as time, this is like the motion of a particle. Okay? Motion of a fluid particle in a specified velocity field, which is a function of two spatial dimensions and time. Okay, and u is divergence free, because divergence of this is just divergence of delta B by B naught, because B naught is a constant, and that is zero. Okay, so following a magnetic field line in a snapshot of MHD, let's say turbulence, is the same as following a particle trajectory in two-dimensional hydrodynamics. And here I sort of suggest that perhaps if you look at a dynamical situation where things are changing with time, evolving, you probably get an ensemble average. Okay.
Hmm.
here, x. Think of z as time. X is 2D space. Spatial position vector. Right? So, now we'll move on to borrow things from hydrodynamics. We'll borrow it in a completely lowbrow fashion. And please welcome, welcome comments from the hydro people. So, correct me wherever I'm wrong. Okay, so I wish to discuss particle motion in hydro turbulence. Okay, so let's go back where it started with this, let's say, tautology by Taylor, that if you follow a fluid particle and look at its mean square position in an average sense, okay, because it's moving around, then it's essentially equal to its Lagrangian velocity correlation integrated over time. Okay, this is straight away from the equations of motion. So it's very clear that a fluid particle, okay, will be influenced by the largest eddy, okay, because they have most of the velocity. So this quantity, which can be measured, it's a very useful thing, because both can be measured independently and checked. Okay, it's clear that the motion, this quantity, the mean square position, is non-universal because it depends on the outer scale. So it depends on the pumping and so on and so forth. It could be anisotropic over various scales. Okay? A quantity which behaves differently is the separation between two fluid particles. So long as that separation, let's say, remains in the inertial range, okay, then it's clear that these two fluid particles will move together when they are attracted by a large scale eddy, and only an eddy of the scale of the separation will influence them significantly. Okay, it essentially comes from the Kolmogorov law that delta V over that scale scales that goes as that scale power 1/3, and which is much larger than the delta V caused by a larger eddy or a smaller eddy. Okay, so there is some kind of locality. Okay. So Richardson actually observed this not by looking at small particles, but by looking at the separation of balloons in air. Okay, and he formulated what is now called Richardson's T-cube law. Okay, so it's that the mean square separation goes as T-cube. Okay, we'll see why that this should be so. Okay, so it's clear that it's sort of super diffusive. Okay. It's more than ballistic, certainly. Definitely more than diffusive, more than ballistic. Okay. Now, we wish to look at finer quantities. That is the probability of the pair separation as a function of time. Okay, this is the interesting quantity. So you imagine that you put many marked pairs, you know, tag them initially. Placed in all kinds of orientations in the fluid, you let them go and keep following them and see how they separate as a function of time. And if you work hard enough, you might be able to get this experimentally. People have got it. Okay. First thing is, this integrated over all space, two-dimensional, three-dimensional, whatever, is unity. Okay, it's a probability of all. So clearly, if there is an equation for its first derivative, okay, as there should be. I mean, give it to you at t equal to 0, it's natural that it evolves from there. Then, because it comes out, it should be equal to minus divergence of some current. Okay, the big question is, what is this current? Richardson had his guesses. Oh, 1926. Okay? So, he said, well, let's assume the simplest diffusion current is the one given by Fick's law. It's minus diffusion coefficient times the gradient of the distribution, whatever it is. In this case, the probability distribution. Here, he observed that the diffusion coefficient is scale dependent. It depends on the separation. Why? Because given a separation, the velocity, that the relative velocity of separation goes as separation to 1/3. The time goes as what? That scale divided by that velocity, which is scale to 2/3. So clearly the diffusion coefficient, which is proportional to velocity squared into that time, decorrelation time, should go as scale to 4/3. Yes. Yes, yes, yes. Yes. A clarification. You are talking about a question. Are you referring to x square average or r square average? Same problem. Fine. Okay. Okay.
And then this integral
right.
The line
to be
converged.
I see. Okay.
Otherwise there is no such description.
I agree.
And it's absolutely not clear why it should be converged.
I see. Even in I put a question over here that you could question the very basis of this formalism of using a phenomenological diffusion coefficient. Because in three dimensions, the statistics of the velocity field is not Gaussian. So, assuming a diffusion coefficient, which goes as a power law, would sort of guarantee scale invariant solutions for the probability distribution of separations, okay, which need not obtain if the statistics of the velocity fluctuations is intermittent. Okay? But in two dimensions, there seem to be quite good experimental evidence. Okay? That A, the velocity fluctuations have Gaussian, at least in the range of inverse cascade. And two, that Richardson's prescription seems to be doing pretty good. Okay? We'll come to it. Okay.
For me, the issue of long-range correlation is problematic, and I just don't understand it at all. But the field line is different than with the wandering of a particle in hydrodynamic turbulence, because the field line ties particles that fit the field line that are way, way far away from each other.
Correct.
If you separate them a lot, that causes a lot of field line tension and pulls it back.
Yes.
It's not clear.
Oh, no. The analogy I draw is only between a snapshot of MHC turbulence and of particle motion in hydrodynamics. This is exact. Okay? But it doesn't say anything about the dynamics of MHC turbulence.
No, but the dynamics is going to induce long-range correlation along the line. You know, if you have a lot of energy right here, right, these bits of the line out here are not disturbed, right? So it just bends the line and it comes back to where it was.
Fine.
Right? If the line has a long-range correlation and memory of where it was.
Yes.
And it retains that because of tension in the field line.
Yes, and that will come in through the dynamics. That will come in through the dynamics.
This is in a snapshot.
No, in a snapshot this analogy is exact. No. He's talking about it as a time development.
We're talking about the system. You have a correlation along the line at a given instant of time.
That is right.
If you see that some line, you ask what is its deviation here, and if this correlation is its deviation there.
But that is what you observe in a snapshot, and that is what I would observe if in, let's say, 2D hydroturbulence, I had plotted a space-time picture. X, Y, and T. I will see a particle move like that. Okay? And what you think of as a field line having this correlation will be shown by a single particle moving through space-time.
But if it moves through space-time, one can quite easily imagine that it loses its memory of distant time to the past.
Yes?
The
oh, wait!
It's not evidence to the field line that, you could just let it arbitrarily wander off as you go to infinity.
So that clearly depends on the dynamics of the field line.
Yes, but the dynamics will affect the snapshot in time.
So you give me a snapshot and I'll map it to an exact problem in 2D hydro motion.
But the exact problem in 2D hydro would be one with long time memory.
So it depends on the statistics. I agree. Okay?
And I don't know how to do better, so please just go on.
No, we'll go on. Okay. That is right. No, but Steve insists that there is some dynamical correlation, and as far as I can tell in a snapshot, I'm just describing what I see in terms of velocity fields. Yeah. Yeah, go on. Maybe we should pull the board. Let it go. I can switch it off. Yeah. No, that's not what I'm considering.
Right. So, in this case, the fuel
line, this can't happen with a Nalsenic perturbation.
Right. So, parts of it are very close together as, in terms of actual distance as crow flies,
mm-hmm.
but in terms of, say, a real particle that can follow the fuel line, it would be very different.
True, but you can't do this with a shear Nalsenic perturbation.
Okay.
You have to turn it around,
okay.
So you need a parallel perturbation. Yes, which is what happens with the shear alpha perturbation.
Sorry.
Yeah, go on.
I'm always getting up.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay. Just a minute.
You started with the velocity
of my flight.
Yes. Right here, we had a couple of explosions, right? And again, wave packets from the field line. Right? A bunch of wave packets on the field. Now, these are going to pass through each other and create alphane turbulence.
Yes.
Around here.
Yeah.
But you can already see
mm-hmm.
sort of a long-range correlation here because, you know, each one of these things, all it does is pop the field lines up. There's no wandering of the field lines as you go towards infinity.
Fine. Go on. Yeah, I agree.
Whereas if you take any of these diffusion things
get
diverged.
No, I'll
as they go towards infinity.
Okay. Now, imagine
right.
that you have...
about each of the individual sort of little...
No, just a minute, let me understand. You've made two wave packets like this, they interact, and then once they interact, they go through this way, right? As a snapshot, yes. As it is.
Sorry, freeze it right
like
this.
Freeze it like this.
It always comes back sort of the same.
Absolutely.
It's a long-range correlation, even though
I agree.
Individually here, it might seem to wander away from each other.
Right. Completely agree. So you give me a situation where you have two wave packets, okay? They are interacting, colliding and moving away. And let's say you had to take a snapshot, Okay? So you have a bump over here, another bump over there. Okay, this is Z. And if I were to consider that as time, then it's clear that I'm creating the mapping to a 2D hydro problem is a very peculiar hydro problem. Okay? I will show you that a case where you have something that's statistically homogeneous, where you have wave packets all over. Okay? Like strong Elfin turbulence maps to a fairly sensible hydrodynamic problem. Okay? It is true that if you create these situations, I can't describe all situations with a sensible velocity field. But it's true that for every snapshot, I'll give you a velocity field which might be very peculiar. That is quite right if you are dealing with just two wave packets. But if you consider a situation which is statistically homogeneous, which is quite reasonable in turbulence. That is, oh no, but I think it's there. I think there are two different questions. One is Steve's question, which is about the usefulness of such an analogy when you can have a situation regarding Alfin waves where you have two packets. Okay, and it seems to imply that a particle can do all this and then come back. So it's doing something very peculiar if you think of Z as time. Sure, I agree. Okay. So it's clear that even though the snapshot analogy with hydro turbulence is exact, in this situation it's useless. It calls for a very peculiar velocity field. Okay? Grisha's question is something else. It says, okay, you have this analogy, you can say what you want, you can, you're essentially interested in field line saturation, but many of these questions seem to be meaningless if you can't establish that a correlative of that is convergent. Right? Meaning, your question is about the use of such a diffusion formalism. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, wait. Okay, so let me make a careful statement on that. I think I need this lower. All I'll say is, I've just given Richardson's formalism, which is 1926. Okay? Which seems to be useful in two dimensions. Okay? For two-dimensional hydro turbulence in the inverse cascade regime. Fine. Yes. But you see, for the mapping of magnetic, for the wandering of magnetic field lines, only 2D hydrodynamics.
This
one
skips right
itself.
In 2D hydrodynamics, you use velocity as a function. Consider now snapshot.
Yes.
It wanders, it goes away.
Yes.
Now, in your situation, there is something which just oscillates around.
Why?
It is not a 2D turbulence as we know it. It is something.
No, no, why does it?
Turbulence. Because of this picture, because your lines, they don't go away like
that. Of course they do. Of course they do. Unless you. No, wait. Unless you type the lines down, they don't separate forever. I have, for instance, you give me a new magnetic field and you stir it, okay, with outer scale line, homogeneously, okay, isotropically, field lines will diverge forever. They will never come back unless you type them down. That is true. So we are looking at situations where we are not looking at the boundaries. They are not tied to walls. when we say that single and separate as fine.
And you think of putting the separating the field lines, right?
Yeah.
You don't want to do that because they get stronger and stronger.
But let's imagine. Well, they do, but that is a dynamical situation. I completely agree with you. So that is what leads to turbulence. That's what leads to wave packet collisions, alpha waves, and storm turbulence, for instance. I'm just looking at a snapshot of it. You agree with me that specify any height, Z, and I have stored things on a scale L. They'll separate let's say, Z to 3/2. You increase it even further and give me even more stirrings. It'll keep happening. Of course, it'll act back on whatever you're stirring. I mean, your library or whatever it is. But that is what sets up waves. That is dynamics.
It happens at every scale. You start to realize.
Yes.
You have to go back to where it was. This can't make it wonder.
Of course it wonders. Of course, they don't know that. See, the fact that they want to come back to where they are depends on being tied to boundaries. If not, they just know that. I mean, what stops them? Well, look at it as simple as this. No, that's not true. What if you have, for instance, let's say supernovae, going off, let's say statistically homogeneously, in an infinite galaxy. I'll give you a new magnetic field. This supernova will push this much, another one will push it a little more, and so on and so forth. It will be kind of work. Only if it has the lines. Otherwise, I can take a field line, I disperse. Disperse it. Of course. Absolutely.
Even when you move it here, it is not tied there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But we are looking at stationary situations. We are looking at a situation which is homogeneous, stationary in time. Things have been stored for a long time. They're steady driving. And this wanders effectively infinitely. That's one of them. Where do we tied it? So if you tied it, for instance, at some scale, I'd say, okay, look at a much smaller scale, if that's relevant.
You start with a wider field.
Yes.
Right? You've got two field lines out here. Yeah. And the further you go towards infinity,
yeah,
the faster you have to stir it to get
into divergence. I agree with you. These are statistically steady situations where you've been stirring for a long time.
We can't resolve
this. Okay. If you tied them down. Otherwise, magnetic field lines will do what they want. Computationally, no. I mean, estimates, yes. I'll give it analogies, yes. Okay? So it's just something very brief on 2D hydro turbulence for those unfamiliar. Okay? If L is the driving scale, and we look at scales larger than that, we assume steady driving on this scale. Okay? There's an inverse cascade of energy to these larger scales. Okay? What goes in the forward direction is called entropy, which is essentially mean square vorticity. Okay? So the velocity fluctuations on these large scale, again, scales in this Kolmogorov fashion as r to 1/3, and the rough decorrelation time scales as r to 2/3. So these are for scales larger than the driving scale in two spatial dimensions. Okay? The power spectrum of these fluctuations can be written in this fashion. Okay? It's essentially restating this. Okay? These two lines are being restated as a power spectrum in two-dimensional space and one in time. So two spatial wave numbers and one frequency. Okay? So if you notice, this has a structure which is very similar to let's say a snapshot of alpha turbulence. If you look at the power spectrum of alpha turbulence, okay, I wish I had another let's see. Yeah, okay. So I'll try to put these okay. I don't know how to put it. Not good, right? But you can see, okay. Please to compare. Okay. Okay, this with okay. Not very good, but we'll have to do. The power spectrum here for 2D hydroturbulence with the power spectrum for strong alpha turbulence. This is a pure spatial power spectrum. Okay? So you can take it at a given instant of time. Okay? I'm assuming that the turbulence is homogeneous, means space filling. Okay, in this case, and statistically steady, but we are looking at a snapshot. Okay, it's a function of k top, which is kx, ky, and k parallel. K parallel plays the role of frequency. Okay, so they have they're identical in structure. Q, which gives a perpendicular scale in strong alpha turbulence, gives a similar is a counterpart of the inverse frequency on some scale in 2D hydro. Okay, both scale as a spatial scale to 2/3. Okay, so this is at the level of power spectrum, nearly identical in terms of scalings. Okay, there might be one strong difference though. Okay. Yeah. Take okay, it's the Fourier transform of let me say it's related to the Fourier transform of VI XP VJ X plus R T plus T prime. You take this quantity, take a Fourier transform in space and time that gives you E of K and omega. Okay? So the level of two-point correlators, they are nearly identical. Okay? The inverse cascade regime in 2D hydroturbulence and a spatial snapshot of strong alpha turbulence. Okay? I don't know about higher order correlators. For 2D turbulence, I've read statements that there are experiments establishing that it's sort of Gaussian. I don't know what the theoretical progress is. Gresha, question, 2D hydro turbulence in the inverse cascade regime, what's known about the fluctuations, statistics of the fluctuations? Other guys?
No, that's not very possible.
This is experimental? Theoretical? Yes. Okay. Theoretical? Okay. Now, I can't make a similar statement about strong alpha turbulence. I don't know how intermittent it is. I don't know what the higher order correlators are. Okay. At the level of two-point correlation functions, they are nearly identical. The inverse cascade regime in 2D hydro and the 3D structure of strong alpha turbulence. So, tell me, Steve, you have objections now to... No, there is no physical analogy in terms of the dynamics. I mean, I'm not drawing one. Okay. So there could be an inverse cascade of helicity in 3D MSE turbulence. Okay. I haven't looked into it, but I mean, what do you know about it? I mean, I've read Pukes' paper on using EDQNM and EDQNM, right? And finding an inverse cascade. I guess there are simulations. I've seen Axel's simulations of something like a 2D cascade. Maybe others have found it in 3D MST simulations. But I haven't really thought about it. I don't know what the spectrum is. Meaning, I know the standard guess is K to minus 1, but... okay, so that is important.
What I'm trying to say is, I don't think I agree with Richard that 2D inverse cascade is gassy. Well, it isn't, okay.
Okay.
What? Well, it's
not gassy. So it is or it is not. So it doesn't matter.
Yeah. So here I'll say.
That's why I asked the question, is it important what we're going to do?
It's relevant, yeah. It's relevant. Sort of, yeah. Okay, here I'd say, Steve, I'll make a statement that field lines will separate, okay, super diffusively, with the separation scaling as z to 3/2 up to the outer scale. Okay? And beyond that, it's it'll be sort of diffusive, and perhaps, I don't know what, I mean, if you've tied it down, then of course, there are long range correlations, things will come back. Okay, so I'm assuming something that goes on forever. So think of it as some intermediate regime in which I'm estimating separation. Okay, why Gaussianity? Okay. Well, if you're interested in the probability distribution function of separations, okay, Gaussian statistics in V implies that what we know at, let's say, the second order fixes everything. Okay? There aren't scaling exponents at every order of correlation. New ones appearing. Okay? So then, Richardson's phenomenological diffusion coefficient, which is a power law in the separation, can be expected to work reasonably well. Okay? Reason? Let's stick it in Richardson's equation for the evolution of the probability. It's like a diffusion equation where it's written in, so I've assumed that initially pairs are released isotropically in the plane. Okay? And I ask what happens at time t. So, here is the equation where I've thrown out the theta dependence. Okay? And this has a scaling solution for the special case where pairs are released at almost zero separation. So imagine that the driving scale is small, okay, you are in the inverse cascade regime, and you've released it above the driving scale, okay? But even that scale is small compared to the scale you're looking at, because particles are going to separate even more, then the scaling solution says that the probability is a stressed exponential. The similarity variable is r to 2/3 divided by time. Okay? T cube over here simply says that the area over which a small spot will spread, okay, is the area of that goes as T cube. So same as Richardson's law, which says that R square is like T cube. Okay? Yeah. If you look at all the fine structure, yes. Fingers, little things, yes. But not in a coarse-grained sense, which is what is implicit in a diffusion-like description. Yeah. Okay? Just for the probability density. Yeah. It's not the passive scalar split. It's for the probability density. So it's in separation space, not in physical space. Okay? So there's a recent paper by in Physical Review Letters in 99 where these three authors performed a 2D simulation, a 2D experiment in a very shallow tank. They had little magnets at the bottom, and they used, I think, stratified salt solution, which is stably stratified. They passed the current through it. The interaction of the current and the magnetic field drove turbulence. And they looked at the inverse cascade regime. They looked at all sorts of things, including the scaling of velocity as a function of separation, the power spectrum, and so on. Okay? And they also tagged particles, thousands of particles. Okay, they watched single particles diffuse in a non-universal fashion. They watched the pairs of particles, you know, stick to each other for a long time and then suddenly move in a very non-Brownian fashion. Okay? And having collected the statistics of many of these particles, okay, they plotted a probability distribution for the pair separation. I think there's an excellent fit to this. Okay, it's also a stretch exponential. The probability distribution at different times when written in terms of the scaled variable all fall on top of each other. Okay? They used a slightly different fit, but I think if only they had used, what they do is to use this formula, okay, for a one-dimensional distribution. Unfortunately, I mean, this is after all in its cylindrical coordinates, right? I mean, it's in 2D. So if you want a one-dimensional probability distribution, you should multiply this by R, essentially. Okay? I think they simply dropped this factor. Okay? So if they had only used that factor, it would have, I think, been a much better fit. But they found a very impressive... So now back to magnetic field lines. So what can you expect in Stoller fin turbulence? Well, so nothing surprising considering all that we've discussed. We expect the mean square separation to scale as z cube, which is distance along the field line. The probability distribution of separations will assume this scaling form. Okay, it's a function of separation perpendicular to the mean field, R is perpendicular to the mean field, and Z is along it. It's very similar to 2D hydro, only if the statistics is Gaussian. Otherwise, it's a strong assumption that the PDF depends on only one similarity variable. That is something to be definitely checked. It's a sort of indirect probe of intermittency. So what one could do is to take a snapshot of field line configurations, let's say like this, a really beautiful picture provided by Jason. Ah, okay. So this is a snapshot. Take something like this, look at how the PDF evolves. Okay, you can check whether self-similarity holds or fails, in one realization, one snapshot. And then you can look at different time configurations. It will give you some ensemble averaging. And you can check that to improve your noise. I mean, to reduce noise. I don't know if this is true. This is a suggestion. Okay? It's a sort of probe of statistics too. Intermediate turbulence is perhaps more promising from the point of view of statistics. Okay? So let me just go through it. That the RMS velocity difference on some scale, perpendicular scale R, goes as R to 1/2, so long as that scale lies between the outer scale and the critical scale when there's a transition to strong turbulence. Okay? The parallel scale remains as L. Okay? So expect R square average to scale as Z square. It's just a linear separation of field lines. Okay? Individual interactions are weak, so it takes many wave periods for cascade to develop. And you know, in weak turbulence theory, statistics can be established as Gaussian to whatever relevant order you're working. Okay? Of course, it's not entirely clear to me whether it will also work in intermediate turbulence. Okay? Because of the two small parameters, one of them is order unity. The other is small. Okay? But it's certainly something where the statistics can be expected to be closer to Gaussian than in strong turbulence. Okay? So if we assume Gaussianity, then use Richardson's prescription, the diffusion coefficient scales as R. Okay? And the PDF is an exponential in the variable R by Z. Okay. So nearly done. Just a bunch of questions actually for the audience. Okay. So, suggestions and questions. What if I look at really large or really small scales? Scales larger than, for instance, the outer scale. Well, perhaps one has to take into account an inverse cascade of helicity. Okay? It's not at all clear to me that the inverse cascade of helicity should have a spectrum which goes as 1 over k. Okay, whatever simulations I've been seeing over the last week or so doesn't necessarily support such a scale invariant form. Many complications seem to, there seem to be all sorts of complications. Okay? So it's not at all clear to me. But if that is the case, where the spectrum is k to minus 1, then the separation, the mean square separation goes as z to 3/2. So as you can see, okay. And Chuck, I'd like to know statements about statistics in this regime. Okay. Anyone who's worked on it? Also, in a large Prandtl number regime, okay, now you're looking at magnetic fields on really small scales. Let's say on scales between the resistive and the viscous scales. Okay? Then you can expect nearby field lines to separate exponentially. Okay? I don't know about the statistics. But if you assume that the statistics is Gaussian in each one of these cases, you can write down an expression for the PDF. Okay? But I'm not even sure about the physics of what is happening on these extremely large and small scales. One, because I don't understand this inverse helicity cascade, and two, because I distrust the isotropic dissipative terms when we are looking at scales close to the dissipation scale. Okay? So I don't know how relevant it is. But overall, you can keep in mind that if you imagine this to hold, then on very small scales, field lines start separating exponentially, and then algebraic with weaker and weaker power. Okay, it's like exponential, z to 3/2, z, and then z to 3/4. Okay, so it's getting weaker and weaker. Okay, now this is something I haven't investigated at all. Okay, perhaps interesting in molecular clouds, where on a whole range of scales, the perturbation is more like a bunch of shocks rather than something where you have a cascade down to small scales. Okay, it could be interesting. I don't know what the questions are here.